Welcome everyone. Good afternoon. My name is Dimitris Ballas. I'm a professor of economic geography in the Faculty of Space and Sciences here at this university. And I'm delighted to welcome today Professor Danny Dorling, Halford McKinder Professor at the University of Geography, the University of Oxford. This is an event that is a collaboration between a new program, the IELTS Erasmus Mundus Research Master Program, that we started last year. And as part of that program, it's built on our Research Master Program in the Faculty of Special Sciences. And we have invited speakers to come to teach and have sessions with our students. And in that context, we decided to join forces with the Rudolf Agricola School of Sustainable Development, especially given that Franz Sitzma, the director of the school, is a very close colleague and also working together on the IELTS program, which builds on the research masters that he coordinated for quite some time, a very successful program here in this university. So we are very happy that we have the opportunity to combine that program, and that's the first of very many sessions like that, making the most of our visitors and engaging with society and having a public lecture. So this was this session is follows from a private lecture with students from our faculty, and we have an open event in a very hot, timely topic. So I would like to say a few more words. I'm really feel very happy and privileged to have known Danny for over 20 years. Also worked together in the UK on a number of projects and publications. And Danny has published more than 50 books. Lose count. I think he writes a book every week or so. His work is extremely powerful and impactful and relevant to society on social and spatial inequalities, I would say is the way to describe it, and engaging with issues that are really meaningful and are about what social science is about, and science is about, I would say. And it's extremely also relevant to the Rudolf Agricola School of Sustainable Development. So I'm delighted to have Danny with us, and I would like to hand over now to the director of the school, my very good friend and colleague, Franz Sitzma, who is going to also say a few words and then moderate the discussion after Danny's lecture. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dimitris. I'm happy to also say a few words. I will be moderating the discussion. Yesterday, we already had a discussion with some students. Quite a few are here in the room. We're happy to co-host this event, but we are also in this Ivan Gardurek room here. Gardurek was a sociologist, and I feel we're sort of in place here. I mean, because the work you do, although you're trained as a geographer and in math, I think we can feel at home here. So that's good. It was very empirical. You're also very empirical, and your work is sort of sociological. And I will hand over to you. We will do discussion after, but I think it's nice to know a bit about the audience. So first I would like to say, ask who is in the IELTS Research Master? Good. Who is studying something else at the university ground? Good. Who is a PhD student at a university ground? That's also studying something else, good. Now, how about having a personal connection with the UK somehow? Good. Okay, what is that?
My dad lives in London.
My dad lives in London.
My daughter lives in the Newcastle.
Newcastle, good.
And I moved here from the UK.
Why? Covered most of the content. We are very happy to host you, and I would say, then take it away.
Thank you. Thank you ever so much for inviting me here. It's lovely to be back, and lovely to meet new people, and to meet my friend who, what he didn't say, has introduced me to more beaches in the world than anybody else. If you want somebody who knows, the beach to go to on any particular island in the Aegean. He's sitting there. They're all different. I should say something about the title, first of all. Britain was one of those places that led the neoliberal revolution in Europe, with Margaret Thatcher at first in the late 1970s, early 1980s. This came from the United States. It's an experiment where the idea was that if you behaved in a certain way, you'd let people simply do more of what they wanted. You made a small state. Wealth would trickle down. Everybody would get happier. It's an experiment which has completely failed. I rarely meet anybody that tells me nowadays it was a good idea. I've added the word failing because failed state has a particular meaning. Failed states are actually very few. They are states where everything stops working. But failing, no longer working as you should, standing out, being different, I think can be applied to the UK in particular. There is a failed state index. If you get bored, if you just Google failed state index, you can see how the UK has been slipping down it. It's produced for all the countries of the UN by a body. I'm going to try not just to talk about the UK, but most of it's going to be the UK. About 40, 50 minutes, 40 slides, quite a lot of graphs. But I'll try and relate this more widely over what we can learn. Some of this is quite personal to me. I was born in 1968 in the city of Oxford. I've lived almost all my life only in England. Just went abroad for a short amount of time. It's where my family are all from. I have no other passports. I have no way out. I have some nieces who are temporarily out of the country, but nobody's planning yet to leave. So I'm invested. I'm personally, socially invested. So I'm studying something where I have enormous bias. You'll see later just how much. I can't help that. I recently went to Paris and sat in a conference of people who study the UK in France. Their specialism is that they're experts on the UK, but they are French and they live in France and at Sciences Po. And it was the weirdest experience ever of hearing people discuss your country as an interesting analytical object. You know, it is, I warn you. And they were all really expert at really obscure politicians, the way you kind of showed you knew your stuff. But it felt a bit painful, really, when you see. And I think it's really interesting. Comparative studies of people without a vested interest. Let's start clicking through some of these. Welcome. There's a book. Started work on the book about 3 years ago. It came out in September. It's called Shattered Nation: Inequality and the Geography of a Failing State. There were lots of arguments about whether we should or should not put a shopping trolley on the cover in ICE, whether the meaning of it was said nasty things about certain people. We're very into worrying about that kind of thing. When I started writing the book, I thought we needed to make the case that Britain was a failing state and things were going badly wrong. I finished the first draft on the day when there was a vegetable called a lettuce, and it was in an office in London. And I finished my draft and sent it to the editors just as the lettuce beat Liz Truss, the Prime Minister, and lasted longer than she did before going mouldy. She did 49 days. So this book is finished at the point when the international money markets, I'm guessing you know some of this story, international money markets told the Prime Minister of Britain, you can't do that because it's too nasty. And withdrew the support of the money. Our rate of interest rose to the highest in Europe. We still have to pay 5.5% interest if we want to borrow money. This is our government. If we want to borrow some money for 30 years, we have to pay this enormous interest rate because the international banks no longer trust the UK as a state that might not go bust. That's what the interest rate is about. It wasn't many years earlier that we were talking about the pigs. You know, Portugal, Italy, Greece and Spain poo-pooing their bad management, or irresponsible places where people don't know how to do banking. And we know in Britain, because we've had the Bank of England forever, and we're safe with our special currency, the pound sterling, right? Which is backed up by what? That's the problem. Fundamentally, I think the most important thing or reason about why this has all occurred is because we're sitting here. That blue line is the United Kingdom. The United States is just next to us. This is the OECD index of inequality in income, Gini measure. There's Turkey, there's Bulgaria. I get really annoyed about Bulgaria, because if Bulgaria could just be slightly better, I could say the most unequal country in Europe, but we're the second. Bulgaria has as many changes of prime minister that the UK does. It just actually has elections for them. Mexico, Chile, Costa Rica, South Africa. On the other side of us, Lithuania, Latvia, Israel. Okay? That's Israel, including the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The UK has a higher income inequality, higher divisions in terms of well-being than the whole of the territory of Israel. It's a remarkable situation to get to. You drop down, and I've just highlighted the larger countries. This is Italy, which has elected that particular government, which people often say, oh, look at what's happening to Italy. Well, it's not actually that different from other parts of Europe. And I'd argue its politics isn't. Here's Spain. Here's the Netherlands, if you were wondering where it is. Just to the right of Germany, that's what I put. Just to the right of France. Not far, but kind of, what are you doing over here? Anyway, this is France and Germany. They're more equal than the Netherlands as societies now. There are only four countries that separate France and Germany from Finland. Quite remarkable things have been going on in Europe if you concentrate on the single statistic of income inequality. A lot of other things matter. We'll get through them, but if you wanted one single statistic that helps explain which countries do well, where do people live longer, where do the schools work, where's the housing system fairer, or where is it falling apart, where are people beginning to think there is no future, you're down that end of things. When did this happen? This is the graph of that same index of inequality. It's an average size of the gap between people. We could get you all to rearrange yourself in this room. What we would do, I don't know if this would work here. We can't do this in England because people get really embarrassed. But all you do is you whisper your annual income to your neighbor. And if it's higher, you move that side. We do it 10 times and we've got you arranged in an income parade. Okay, so let's do it. No. Right, okay, right, but to give you a sense that it matters. So go back. This little graph, he's given me a laser pointer. He shouldn't have given me a laser pointer. This little graph, this is the 1960s. Little Danny is born here. 1970, I'm about six here. This is 1974, 75. Wonderful years. Absolutely brilliant. We had a heat wave in 76. You had one too. It's really low because the gap between people is the lowest it has ever been since we had hunter-gatherers on the islands of Britain, right? The most equal we had ever been. Only one large country in Europe was more equal than only slightly, and that was Sweden. I grew up in a Nordic Scandinavian country called England. I did. I'll show you numbers. It was wonderful. That history has been maligned. largely by younger men than me, mostly men, not women, who write the history of Britain, who were never there in the 70s because they hadn't been born, who were quite posh and didn't like it. But the 70s, I think, were pretty good. Then we get to the end of the 70s. That's 1979. Right? Every year, the gap between people grows faster and faster. Till we get up to about 1990, 1991. This is John Major, my favourite Conservative of all time. You know, he stopped that. Then we get Labour Party get elected here. Nothing happens. It's flat. Very unequal. But it's year after year of being very unequal. It's like having high blood pressure. Think of that with a blood pressure graph over time. Right, you're all healthy here, and your blood pressure goes down, starts to going up. It's not good. Not good. This isn't good. Having high blood pressure year after year after year, things begin to fall apart. They get worse. A lovely friend of mine produces failing state art. That's a silk print of how many, 17 feet is about 6 meters. How many pages of regulations you have to read just to qualify for the lowest unemployment benefit in Europe. And the qualifications. So more of these, they will get simpler. I thought I'd start off with the complicated ones. This is Europe, with every country drawn as a circle, shaded by how unequal they are. Here we are, between Germany and the UK. The five Nordic states have an average level of inequality now. Not the lowest level of inequality, an average. There are five circles here, including Belgium, that are more equal than Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and Iceland by income. And there are another five, including Germany and France, which are almost as equal. So there are 15 kind of Nordic countries in the middle of Europe now. Doesn't feel like that. People set light to the front doors of churches and put on yellow vests and riot and do all kinds of things and talk about how awful it is in Germany. It's just, if you step outside and measure it. So now you're getting the feeling that I got in Paris of, yeah, somebody, I've come over from Britain and I'm telling you about where you live and it's not much fun. But you're not doing particularly well here, right? You're going a little bit darker shade because you're a bit more unequal. Nothing like us, but, you know, if you really don't bother, I can tell you what the future's going to be like, right? Russia, not good. Baltic countries next to it. Turkey, not good. Bulgaria, annoyingly not good. Spain, you know, not as bad, but Italy going slightly darker. We have a centre of Europe, which is the most equal place in the world, lowest income inequality in the world, and it's no longer the Nordic countries. And if you've got a good imagination, you can see that those orange lines are heading downwards, right? More countries are becoming more equal than unequal. We never report the good news. We always report bad news. That's why the far right are always winning everywhere in elections, because they elections where the far right win get reported around Europe and around the world. Whereas an election, say in Poland, which involves far more people and is quite remarkable, gets a little bit of news coverage. The nice thing about data and graphs is that it makes you look at everything. That's the UK. Here's Turkey, here's Bulgaria. Okay, so since 2005, this really high level of inequality. Down here at the bottom, these are the most equitable places on Earth. Okay, you might have a little bit less, but at least you don't have those differences. Strange kind of things that are happening. There are three major growth industries in the UK. Well, and tourism, I guess now. The pound kind of goes down. Banking. We are no longer governed by European regulations on our banks, which might have been part of why we left. So we can gamble more. And also, if you've got a lot of money and you don't want it to be seen, well, it's not very far. Gambling. The actual gambling industry. The UK is now, this isn't per capita, this is total. We're bigger than the US for money moving through us for those of you who like a flutter online. Yeah, quietly when nobody else is watching. It's just another 100 euros. We'll do that. And the fourth one, if you like, after tourism, is higher education. We have a higher education business, the highest fees for our own children in the world, higher than the average, mean, and median for the US, and much higher fees for overseas. Right? Banking, gambling, higher education, tourism. You can see I'm obsessed by the fact that those lines didn't go down. Yeah. Partly because I live in a milieu where people say, well, Tony Blair was really nice, wasn't he? But kind of maybe if he'd been a bit nicer, we wouldn't be where we are. What he did, and you can see the quote from Margaret Thatcher there, so I won't read it out, is he moved the Labour Party and his friends, not just him alone, across into her territory, and that pushed the Conservative Party further to the right. I mean, they could have been revolutionary and jumped over, but, you know, it doesn't happen. Right? So when the Labour Party in the late 90s changed and followed politicians from here a little bit earlier and went for the third way, but interpreted the third way as meaning don't worry about how much the inequalities are as long as people pay their taxes. They can have lots of money and be tough on the feckless poor. It meant that the Conservative Party in Britain, the strongest, oldest party, was pushed to the right of where Margaret Thatcher had been in terms of ideology, in terms of what people believed should be done. And the Conservative Party spent a lot of years in the wilderness. They lost the 1997 election, big time. I was in Bristol then. I can remember celebrating when William Waldegrave, a member of the aristocracy, lost his seat. And Labour went from third to first, and we had Bristol West. It felt very good, the 1997 general election. But if you adopt the policies of the Conservatives, and for 2 years Labour did, it actually stuck to the spending plans. It said it would, and it did. If you do that, what happens to those young men and women in the Conservative Party in 98, 99, 2000, 2001, 2, 3, 4, these are many years. They went to meetings in buildings in Tufton Street, very near to Parliament, where they could pretend they were in power but weren't, and they discussed things that should happen. And in particular, they knew, that the EU was the great enemy. We just had to get out of Europe. That we were a lazy, sick country, which was being too nice to the poor. That our rightful place in the world was number one, and it was up to them to regain it. Common thinking. 2015, George Osborne, who wasn't one of these, George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, said that if you follow my economic plan, then by the year 2030, the UK will be the richest large country in the world in per capita GDP in just 15 years. You just carry on doing what George was doing and we will be the richest because we have to be number one. Right? Now, that have to be number one thinking. Where on earth does that come from? I mean, I should have said at the start about the shininess of the UK. You know, obviously not necessarily a brilliant country over some of the things it did in the world. But maybe that's where the number one comes from, because we did have the largest empire in the world. We were the richest place after here was rich in the world. But you'd think you'd learn that wanting to kind of like make America great again stuff is a bit silly. You know, if we discovered a second North Sea oil field, but to the west, and nobody was that bothered about us taking all the oil out and, I don't know, invented some amazing things like, I don't know, a vacuum cleaner that's special, right? Or she did that. That's about it, really. This I'm trying to tell you the story part of what happened, but in graphs. So I think it was 2009 when the Conservative Party left the European People's Party. The European People's Party, for those who don't know, who don't have an in-depth knowledge of Europe, which if you're British, you get, because you spent years debating since 2016, the European People's Party is the coalition of Conservative parties. Our Conservative Party leaves it because it's too moderate. And in 2014, we joined an alliance, our Conservative Party, with Alternative for Deutschland and a load of other people like that, right on the edge of fascism or fascists. It's our Conservative Party. So this map is a map where every country of Europe is made the size of the number of Conservative voters in it, I think at the 2014 election. And the UK has shrunk to nothing because we had no Conservative voters in 2014 because we had no political party in the Conservative bloc of Europe because they'd moved so far to the right. A slide I haven't got, produced in the Financial Times using work from political scientists around the world, has that by the time that Liz Truss was Prime Minister, of every political party in all the countries of the world except for the very poorest, which they can't measure, of all these political parties, the British Conservative Party on economic policy was the most far right of everyone in every country, including middle-income countries. I mean, somebody has to be, right? Somebody has to be at that extreme. My preference is it wasn't the country that I was born and grown up in that became like that. And our Labour Party was also one of the most right-wing of the Social Democratic parties, to the right of the Democrats in the US. What kind of things happen? Well, what if you see these things happening should you start worrying about? Let's just put it like that. This is the proportion of the workforce who are working in the public sector, starting in 1992, going through to a couple of years ago. And you can see it just goes down, right? The different colours are all about the complexities of, am I a public sector worker? I'm not. I work in a British university. That means I'm entirely in the private sector, right? Legally, everything else. We privatise our university. Things do get better if you're worried this is going to get too morose. We have a sector called further education, which is kind of technical if you're learning an actual useful skill, all those things in the pandemic we discovered we needed, right? Our further education colleges were all privatized, and last year they nationalized them all at the stroke of a pen. The way you do that in Britain is the Office of National Statistics releases a press release saying, we've looked at the income and decided that according to the national accounts and international banking finance regulations, because you get so much money for government, you're not a private business anymore. And on exactly the same day, on the same hour, the government secretary of state writes a letter to all the FE colleges, all the further education colleges, telling them, you're now part of my department, that's nationalisation, nobody can borrow any money. And implicitly, but we never put it explicitly, and can all of you who are paying yourself a salary more than the Prime Minister stop it, please? Because that's the unwritten rule in the public sector. You're not allowed to pay yourself more than the Prime Minister if you work in the public sector. Public sector spending. Now, I've told you this sort of terrible tale of things getting worse, but you look at this graph, and you see it's going to be death by graphs, but we'll try and make it better later. This one starts in 1980. Oh, it's nice, this one. It ends in 2026, right? Because I can see the future. The reason it ends in 2026 is that every country in the world tells the International Monetary Fund how much it intends to spend on public sector costs in the next few years. So you don't have to listen to what they tell you. Right, you've just got to go and get the IMF data and have a look, and you can see what your government has said. The reason it goes up like that is because we're not a failed state. Things haven't completely fallen apart. The population has got older. The last time we had two children per couple was in the 1960s. We've got an aging population. That costs more money. People have some basic demands. They're not willing to see children on the streets. So you have to have a state that can do certain things. We quite like the military in Britain, so we spend more on that than anybody else in Europe. not because we got lots of money, just because, you know, we're into having weapons. But it goes up. I need to tell you why it does these spikes, although you can probably guess. This is 1980. Mrs. Thatcher, she didn't like people very much. Sorry, it's personal. And I do apologize to people of a different political persuasion from Britain than me. I now work, I think, in the rooms where she was taught, by the way, because we got the chemistry building in my department. That's the cuts of the 1980s, so that you can reduce taxes for rich people, which and better off people, which they did. So you cut the state. Here's the lovely John Major. Bit of flatness because of nice John Major. And then we get some more cuts because they feel like they need to do it. 1997, we get a little bit of a rise. 98, 99 planned up to there. It's quite nice. Lots of double glazing, windows in council flats. Didn't tell people about it. Bit more money for the health service. Small war in Iran, you know, because that costs. But none of that matters compared to a banking crisis. That's bailing out the banks, right? So that's why we're spending so highly there, because otherwise, well, we wouldn't have sterling anymore, right? You know, you have to bail out banks. This is George Osborne getting in as Chancellor. That's his cuts. Half of everybody working in local authorities have been sacked by the end of that. Decimation, decimation, decimation. Decimation means 10% cuts. So you've got to decimate again and again and again to do this. This is COVID. Oh, and COVID handled particularly badly where you give your friends contracts to produce things that never appear. Cost you a lot of money, though. Right, so that's COVID spending. And this is what we are looking at happening now. Okay, so there's kind of disasters fit in, particular predilections. But you could say, that's not too bad overall. So what am I going to do? I'm a geographer, so I'm going to compare it to the rest of Europe. There's your four other large countries. And the first thing to see is that they're all affected by a pandemic. But France, interestingly, less. So you might say France couldn't possibly tax its people more. This is public spending. But essentially, it's almost identical to taxation plus borrowing. It's the same thing. I mean, I did maths, trust me. Not an economist, but it's not that different. Here's Italy, Germany, my favorite country for this kind of stuff. Already had four times more incubators than Britain did when the pandemic hit. Although my very favorite's Finland, where they'd been storing PPE since the 1957 flu epidemic, just in case. Anyway, maybe slightly too careful, but that's I would urge. Anyway, the point is, this gap is enormous. The gap between here, and really interesting. The gap's really interesting because it shows you what's possible. Because in every country, people tell you, oh, we couldn't possibly spend a bit more, everything would fall apart. So you can go to France, like I did, and you can wander around Paris, and like all the buildings have fallen down. It's like a wasteland. Like there's nothing, everybody's starving. It's terrible. Like, or maybe it isn't. All right? Okay. Of course, you can spend more efficiently and so on and so on. Banking crisis, 2008. You can see they all had to bail their banks out, but some more than others. If you have a big banking sector, you have to bail out more. If you've got a small banking sector like France and Italy, Germany, then actually the cost of stopping your bank doing what happened in the US is less. Right, so you want to see the Netherlands, hopefully? Where do you think you are? Do you know where you are? Have you got any idea how you compare to the rest of Europe on public spending? Where are you, above average or below average? Who says above? You think you're above average, right? Who thinks you're below? Okay, you're quite split. Let's make it easier. Who thinks that you were above in the 1980s? High spending in the 80s. Okay, and who thinks you're below in the 80s? No, okay, who thinks you're above now? Who thinks you're below now? Hey, the wisdom of crowds. You're doing well. Let's let you out of your misery. So I'll do the Netherlands in a minute. Unless you're very good. Well, it's there. And look, I made it orange anyway. I don't know if that's allowed. Spain. I ran out of colours. I'll do the Netherlands first then. Here you are, okay? Over 50% of GDP being spent on public services in the 80s, right? Clearly, you were a failed kind of communist socialist state back then. It must have been really bad here in the 80s. I don't know. I never came. Yeah, I guess it was just terrible. And then you kind of cut things or moved. Look, it's going down as a percentage, down really fast in the 90s, and way down to here. So you're becoming more efficient and whatever. But anyway, I don't know. I know very little about the Netherlands. And then you almost became British. Right, same. But then you're back up there, just a bit higher, Germany level, being a bit more Germany, and then down, and then. I think there's a fact, look there. I never spotted that. But this is the pandemic rise. You did something like, I don't know, you kept your primary schools open and let kids go to school and didn't panic entirely and save some money?
No.
Okay. Anyway, whatever you did do, you're unusual, right? And now you're currently here along with Spain and dangerously near to the UK. That's what I just say. Unless you think the UK is wonderful, in which case you're heading in the right direction. At the top, Belgium, France, Finland, Norway, wastelands, places full of homeless people, no hope. You know about the children in Finland? They learn nothing in school. They can't speak any languages. The universities are terrible. France, people can't retire. They've got to keep working till they're 90. It's an unbelievable place. They've got no culture left. I shouldn't be skeptical. One for Demetrius. I quite like this one. I didn't spot that when I was doing this. Here's Greece. Spent even less than the UK in the past. Okay. And this was, when did you get rid of the generals? You remember?
1974.
Right. So the generals, Greece was a dictatorship, not a democracy. The generals are in charge. You get rid of the generals in 1974, and that's how long it takes to become more normal than the UK. This is Spain. Who was in charge of Spain? But here we've got a democracy with a House of Lords and a voting system where you can't get what you want and bishops making laws. So you really stand out, because I guess you are actually in a democracy here, but you're the only democracy that's managed to get public spending so low. Anyway, let's stop with my foot in it, and you want to see the rest of this. For those who think the 1970s were terrible, when we were most equal, this is how much pay went up in the UK every year. There was a very short period where it went down when inflation was really high, but most of the 70s, people got better off, even though inflation was high. We're currently, pay is going down in real terms. Okay. For anybody who wants to say, I can remember the 70s, they were terrible. The only problem is the numbers don't back you up. People were thin, lovely, beautiful. Not quite, but this was taken there. The 70s were not brilliant if you're female, but they were not brilliant everywhere if you were a woman. They were getting better. They were nasty in Britain if you were not white. Racism was particularly nasty in the UK in the 1970s. You could make arguments, and in a way it's kind of like utterly inexcusable. You know, if you've never shared out your money so well and you had a lot of money, to still have that wasn't. So I'm not saying the 1970s were great for everybody, but they were pretty good. Let's go forward. We did segregate our schools. We had incredible revolutions in education. I need this graph the other way around, but until about 1965, we had this set of schools that if you passed a test at 11, you could go to, and if you failed the test at 11, you knew you were factory fodder and could never go to university. And we just got rid of almost all of them, apart from 160. The Finns came over to watch what we did, and then they copied it in Finland, right? Which is why they do rather well. Yes, an incredible desegregation. First time I got to go to school with all the children who lived around my neighborhood. You went to the nearest school. This is mortality stats. They narrowed. I used to live in Sheffield. Sheffield had a mortality rate better than the national average in the 70s. Not all great, but it's pretty good on all the numbers. Poverty went down by any measure in the 70s and then up and up. And then it went down for the most extremely poor. So if you remember, you won't remember, you've got no reason you should have known, but one pledge of the Labour government was to reduce child poverty, and they managed to tip a million children from extremely poor into just poor without altering the inequality overall statistic at all. So the only way you can do that, the only way you can make a million children slightly better, and really slightly, so slightly you'd hardly notice. China does this occasionally. You move people just over, and then you can say you've achieved something, but they haven't noticed. The only way you can do that and keep the inequality statistic the same is to have rich people getting richer, and then your overall inequality doesn't change. Housing was affordable when the prices at times were going down. You could buy a house in your mid-20s if you had an average job or above, start a family at the age of 26, send the children to the local school, give up your job if you don't like it and just take another one because there were enough jobs, and go on holiday with everybody else, and everybody went on holiday because you all had a tent and you could go camping, or if you're lucky, a caravan. You know, it was good, and then the house prices rise. We get these inequalities. This is Kensington in the middle of London. This is Grenville, which is kind of symbolic of what went wrong. The tower block was clad with what in effect was inflammable material purely for the satisfaction of the people looking from those houses so that it looked nicer in theory, not for the people in the block, but from people outside the block. We have strikes. These are the strikes of the 1920s. They're enormous. These are the strikes of the 1970s. Big, but nothing like that. And by the way, inequality came down after then. And that's our strikes of last year. The most we've, a lot of strikes, but you have to kind of magnify it to see them in the scope of things. Not many more to go. Eurostat graph. I have no graphs in the book, by the way. And you now know exactly why, because right, you're going, he's going to show me more graphs. I don't have any graphs in the book because, well, they put people off. Right? People don't like graphs. But also, I don't think people would believe them, or they'd think I'd just pick the bad ones. This is a Eurostat graph produced before the UK left the EU, showing how unequal every country in the EU is by geography, the richest area to the poorest area. What you have to try and spot, if you've still got your energy, is what is the second most unequal country in the EU? Not, of course, you know, you've got the idea now. It's always worse in Britain, right? So, you know, there's the United Kingdom, we're there. Which bar is the second highest? Ireland you're going to go for. It's the whole width. That's quite small. We haven't got, Luxembourg isn't there because it's only one geographical unit. There isn't one, right? One remarkable thing about mainland Europe is very similar levels of inequality now in many countries between areas. May not necessarily be appreciated in East of Germany, but Germany has actually leveled compared to what it was. The other thing to notice is those two little lines. And those two little lines mean the UK is so unequal we couldn't fit you on the graph, right? Which is between the richest area and the poorest area. We've got brilliant records over time, right? We've recorded stuff since the 1700s. So we have a data series from the Bank of England about wages and cost of living. So we can compare every single cost of living crisis there's ever been. And this is far worse than the 30s. After 2008, wages went down in real terms. There's a point when they could have gone up, but they didn't. But because we've got records that are so long, we know that there's one cost of living crisis that's longer. It began in 1798. It lasted until 1822. But luckily, if you're into statistical records, because of inflation, we might just beat that and have the worst ever cost of living crisis in the history of Britain. And you can't get early ones because there wasn't a Britain before then. So we're heading for the longest period of people's lives getting worse we've ever had. So I'm going to try and cheer up at the end, but it just kind of is silly. These are two middle-of-the-road journalists, Stephanie Flanders, works for Bloomberg, John Burr Murdoch, Financial Times. You can read the quotes. Nobody disputes this. The poorest fifth of people in Britain are poorer than the poorest fifth in Eastern Europe. There is no reason why the poor in Eastern Europe should be so poor. It's not a kind of, you know, but the UK is a peripheral state. It's on the edge now. It's slipped down. You go to many towns, you will be shocked by what you see outside of parts of London, outside of Oxford, outside of Cambridge. Part of it is caused by Brexit, but only a little bit. Most of it is that living with that high blood pressure, that high inequality. Because while that stays high, some people have got a lot of money coming in each year, most people haven't. The people with a lot buy more things, buy bigger houses, find ways to exploit those who haven't even more. Families that are poor for then two generations and three generations, rather than just poor for one generation, right? Which is why it falls apart. These are the life expectancy projections of the Office of National Statistics, and the bottom line is what really happened. And you can see that our life expectancy began to fall. It fell. Statistically, it fell, okay, but a small amount, but it fell. 2015, 16, 17, and 18 for both men and women. The bit at the end is the pandemic. More people died in the UK because of austerity than because of the pandemic. Women dying earlier than they should do because no Meals on Wheels services, no rural bus services. Cold, couldn't heat their houses anymore. We have babies washed in water, cold water in Oxford, because when you can't pay for the gas anymore, you just don't have gas heating. You don't have hot water. We have homes where they have stopped paying for electricity and they have candles. This is at the extreme. But if things carry on, we begin to actually measure them. At the extreme, at the middle, it's rising numbers of people saying that they don't need a holiday. Not that they can't have one, which is about 40% of all children in the UK have no holiday at all in a year. But we're beginning to see rises of parents saying, why would you want a holiday? What's that? Why would you have a week off away from family and friends? That slowly erodes and you become used to it. You become used to what's going on. And okay, there's jingoism. And there will be people who would be very, very angry, let's just put it modelly like that, to hear what I'm saying in England about this. You know, because two World Wars and one World Cup, we're still second in the Olympics. What else are we good at? There are good things. There are London's cosmopolitan, possibly the best place. But if you've dropped from amongst the G7, having the best health in the world, in the 1950s, there were only six countries where you lived for longer, and they all had a population combined less than the UK. If you brought in the first baby incubators just in time for me to be born, I didn't need them, my brother did. If you had the lowest infant mortality in the world, but if it goes down and down and down, and you see your ranking heading to 36, but also that trajectory. Right now, in a way, I'm kind of moaning too much, because if you're going to have a more equal world, you do need some of the richest countries to go down. It's kind of downward social mobility. It just, there might be gentler, slightly kinder ways to do it than the one we've gone for. Infant mortality, neonatal mortality, the UK in 1990, as I said, when I was born, we were best. 1990, we were seventh in Europe. Only six countries were a better place to be born as a baby. 2015, we'd gone down to 19th. Latest one, we're down at 23rd. Slovakia, Bulgaria, Croatia, Romania, Malta, worse. Different reasons, not all just poverty, but they're all going up. The question is, where do we cross over with the next one? But just to worry you, that's the Netherlands. Right? You're not, I didn't quite realize before putting these slides together and looking that in some ways, some things, not actually that far, far away. But cheer you all up. Okay? At least we're not talking USA here. Right? We're not talking Mississippi, Alabama. We're not talking 2 million people in prisons. We're not talking unbelievable situations. I've got 5 or 10 minutes left, so I have to zoom through. This is a graph from a website of a book coming out in a few months in the US, the kind of things that they start getting there. And that's the words of Bruce Springsteen, which, if you know, born in the USA, it's all about how terrible things are, and it became a kind of anthem of how wonderful it is, right? So it could get worse. We could be singing songs where the lyrics are about how terrible Britain is, patriotically about how great we are. This is the life expectancy distribution of the United States in red. That's how much money people have. Little dot at the far end is the top 1%. And that's England. And really interestingly, despite spending 60% of their massive GDP on health and a huge amount for the rich and health, people in the States don't live a day longer than England. And England is very bad in Europe. Right? So when people tell you that somehow at least the rich benefit in the USA, well, not as far as the numbers are concerned. And it's quite shocking, really. You'd have thought, I was shocked by that. We have more dead babies than the year before. Infant mortality is rising. We have a 20% rise in maternal mortality. That's mothers dying in childbirth in last year because of rising suicides of women who are pregnant or who kill themselves shortly after birth. Right, these are the kind of things happening in Britain right now. And they kind of make a paragraph of a news story. You get used to them. Heights of children. You know, I spent my career measuring really complicated things to talk about what's happening. But now we can just measure the heights of children. These are the heights of 5-year-old boys. Let's take Germany. Taller. You know you'd win, don't you? So you want to get it right. little dip. Now, I think it coincides with my even more favourite politician than John Major, Angela Merkel. Yep. Who, far to the left of any political party in England. Remember that line, spends more on public services? Also does the unthinkable, lets in 1.5 million people from Syria, including a lot of quite malnourished children who've grown up in a war zone. What happens if you do that? Goes down for a little bit. United States, things are not good. France, remember the basket case country that's taxing really highly, where you can retire at 62? Look at their children, right? Really bad news. You know, soon they'll be beating you. Is it? I mean, it's the heights of children, and they're the UK. Begins, remember they're age 5, so they're born 5 years earlier. So if we take that, that's about 2007. So it's beginning about 2002-03. It's not immigration. Actually started under New Labour. Got much worse with George Osborne and the cuts. Right, it's a way of measuring. If you don't believe me that things are bad in Britain, the status from The Lancet, it's a medical journal, you measure concrete, absolute things. child poverty, official measures. What's shocking, if you know the UK, is that Northern Ireland, Scotland now have the lowest rates. When I was a teenager, Scotland had the highest rates. Something's happened. This is positive news, by the way. It's coming, right? My area, southeast, the richest part, once of Europe, in my lifetime, the southeast now poorer than Scotland. The county of Surrey almost went bankrupt. We have many counties and districts which are now bankrupt. Birmingham is bankrupt, largest local authority in Europe. Children going hungry, official statistics this year, 56% of children with a brother or sister are not able to have enough money to eat food. This isn't peckish, this is properly hungry, which of course explains why they're getting shorter. Right? It stops being, you know, you didn't go to university and learn complicated stuff to have to explain if they can't have food, they will start getting shorter. Who's benefiting? My friend Torsten Bell at the Resolution Foundation invented this really complicated way of graphing things with 20 different bars to show real subtlety, but it's kind of like obvious. You might be wondering why the best of 5% doing better, because the interest rate had to go up so high because the international bankers won't lend us money if we don't pay them more. Who has wealth that they can benefit from interest? It's the best of 5%. The rents have gone up faster in London in the last year than they've ever done before. For the people who've other reasons and complicated, but there is some money in there. I showed the students this earlier and they had it for 20 minutes, so I won't, but just very briefly, we are actually becoming more happy in this period. There's a whole set of complicated reasons. We're getting out of a banking crash. We voted on Brexit. 52% of people thought they're going to get what they want. The other 48% thought it's going to be overturned. We had this quite interesting political leader on the left who attracted 500,000 members, largest political party, I think, in Europe by membership. And then it all collapsed here. This is when Boris Johnson became head of the Conservative Party and made Brexit done. That's his election. These are the happiness levels. That line is when the pandemic first started, right? So we took the pandemic in our stride, didn't dent our levels of happiness at all. The wave two was bad. So that's the second wave, which was worse than Boris Johnson. Here's anxiety, right? And it's, again, our banks have survived, we're doing okay. 2015, we might believe George Osborne's promise that we're going to become the richest country in the world of large countries. We might be excited that Jeremy Corbyn is the new leader of the Labour Party, and we might even think of doing what he promised in 2017, which was to spend almost as much money as Merkel in Germany, the Christian Democrat. But then Boris Johnson becomes Prime Minister, prorogues Parliament, forces through Brexit, and the levels of anxiety reach a peak incredibly fast. And then a virus arrives from China. Only then. It takes some doing to, you know, that's when we knew it was game over. We're leaving. They've won. The rich people are now in control of a country that they have shattered. And we've just voted them in with a massive majority, right? You know, it's going to make you a bit anxious, isn't it? So measure the level of anxiety in your society as a kind of warning sign. We get satirical pictures. This is Banksy, I think, about who's in charge. A lot of cynicism, a lot of no hope. The nice thing was we did get lots of Americans turning up because things were even worse over there. So that felt good. There's a quote here about the newspapers and what they were doing, which you can read, but just how this is back in the 1930s. You know, who decides things, who controls it, who has an effect on public opinion. And I put that in because I've got you two papers that relate to the Netherlands, because I thought I'd put it in. This one was from last year, 2022. It's a normalization of the far right by the Dutch media, a study, right? You've got tens of thousands of social scientists now doing all kinds of studies. And I just put it in because I thought, well, hold it, we've had the normalization in the UK of this simply being sensible, and there is no alternative. You can't possibly tax more because we tax so highly already. Remember that red line rising? Never mention what other countries in Europe do. Always look to the Americas for what your policy should be. Always look west, never look east. Some people sometimes say, I'm a patriot, me. Some people sometimes say, oh, well, the old did okay, didn't they? We have a triple lock, we've looked after the old. We sacrificed the children, you know, we made other people work. This is what happened to the incomes of the average income of the old. Because at the same time as we rose pensions slightly, we made cuts to other benefits that people got if they're poor and old, disability benefits and so on. So there was hardly any increase in real incomes for old people in this period. But at least, you know, we didn't abandon them. Almost at the end, about three slides left, maybe two. There is some amazing news going on. I'm just going to end with stuff that's good. One is this, which was presented as a bad news story. But in the last 2 years, every pay deal by every union has been progressive. So higher paid workers have had a smaller increase in percentage times than lower paid workers. If you take the civil service as a whole, since 2008, senior civil servants in Britain have seen their pay cut by 25% in real terms, junior civil servants by 12%. The gaps between people are narrowing. Why? Because if you don't increase the pay of people at the bottom when inflation is going at 10, 11 or 12%, or for them even higher, they'll starve. Right? We are forced to do this. The Murdoch newspapers, if you work for a Murdoch newspaper, any money you get over £60,000 a year in your income, no increase. Increases only on below that. Murdoch doing it. The last time this happened was the 1930s. So something's going on. Something is beginning to change. Out of desperation, not planned, but when you really run out of money and you've still got a modicum of morality about you, you have to not give more to those people at the top. And a good news story, just one. I could do you a few more, but I'm going to give you this one because we've run out of time. What do you do? What can you do? What can you possibly do? You know, this looks terrible. You can't do anything. Well, maybe you could simply decide that you don't want any children to go hungry or cold. You're told, well, that's impossible. But they did that in Scotland. This year. During the pandemic, Scotland has its own government. It's not very free, but it has some powers. Scotland convened its committee every week to look at what to do in the pandemic. It had slightly different policies to England. It had no parties, right? People were not getting drunk. They were not doing all those things that were going on in London. They took the pandemic seriously. And then when the cost of living crisis began, as you're coming out of the pandemic, the Scottish government convened the same emergency committee that they had convened for the pandemic, because it was just as important, because they knew that as many people die. And that committee met every week. And one thing it did was introduce a few regulations on landlords that they simply couldn't chuck people out into the street quite as easily, because we do that in the UK. And the other thing they did is introduce a small benefit of £10 a week for any child under the age of 6 and a family receiving any welfare payments. The key thing is to get it in. Once you've got it in, you can change it. And then they increased it a little bit. This is after the pandemic. And then in November of last year, a year and a month ago, They increased it to £25 a week for every family, for every child under 16, right? 16, not under 6. So that if you're a family of 3, you get an extra £4,000 a year. And you just get it. Nothing else is taken away because you've got more, you just get it. If you're in Scotland as well, you also get child benefit for the third child. £4,000 a year for a family of 3 children means that your children can eat, they don't have to get shorter, and you can pay for the heating when it gets cold in winter. And this has just happened. I think it is the biggest reduction in child poverty anywhere in Europe since 1989. It's not reported at all in England. Yep. Not reported. There was a point last summer where Gordon Brown said he thought it was irresponsible to do this. And then the Scottish Labour Party shut him up, which I thought was very good. And so in Scotland, the two largest parties, the SNP, the Scottish National Party, and the Scottish Labour Party, have a quiet agreement that they don't touch this. Yeah? And it's the beginning of the way you get out of this. They could only save the children, and they're going to save the children in Scotland, and only in Scotland. But I don't think anywhere else in Europe has done it that fast. And the evaluations are all coming out. And my soft spot for Nicola Sturgeon is she grew up in a normal household in Glasgow, and she liked Wham. Right? So all you need is a Wham fan, George Michael, just to have the tenaciousness to go through. That's my. I can do you other good news stories, they help a bit, but you've got the overall message of it's not good and it's entirely possible to get there. My second good news story, very quickly, as hands are getting ready to moderate. Paper just published, not by me, by James Dennison and Alexander Kirstoff in Political Opinion Quarterly, literally just on the web. Measuring across Europe finds that on average, wherever you have a rise in far-right populist voting, normally amongst the old, you get a counter-increase amongst the young, mainly, that is against being anti-immigration, that's more welcoming. So it's there, based on evidence, based on numbers. You can, if you want, search out an amazing number of stories or evidence that says we're not all doomed. Just like I showed you, the majority of Europe is becoming more equal each year in the most equitable part of the world. That it is actually possible to have a lot of hope even when very, very bad things happen. But it often requires something to be very awful before people are motivated enough to say, actually, I'm going to do something about that. I'm going to vote differently to how I voted before, or I'm going to vote at all, which is our biggest problem in the UK. My last slide, so please think of some questions. Hope. Two quotes for you on hope. I won't read them out. You've got to know and think that it is possible. The UK, almost certainly within 5 or 10 years, will no longer be the most unequal country or on the edge of it of Europe. Because we've got all those pay deals, where people like me have received almost no pay increase, our MPs very little, 2%, with inflation at 10 or 11. That's like an 8% pay cut in a year. Meanwhile, the pay increases at the bottom, they're still below inflation, but they are higher. We are rapidly going to drop down that inequality curve. Not out of some clever, wouldn't this be a good idea, just because we've run out of money, right? When your infant mortality is that bad, when your life expectancy is actually falling, it's really hard for that to continue. We're going to start moving. And this happened before. It happened in the early 1920s and 1930s. By 1939, half of the inequality that existed at the time of the First World War had gone from the UK. Slightly over half. People didn't notice, but the grand country houses had to be given up to the government. The middle class were becoming more like the working class. People couldn't have 3 servants, and they couldn't have 2, then they could only have 1 servant, and they could have none. The most common job in Britain when my grandmothers were young was to be a servant for women. That was what you're most likely to do. By the 1960s, a judge asked a jury whether this is a book you would like your wife and servants to read on Lady Chatterley's Lover. And the jury just looked at the judge and realised that he was from another age because there were no servants left. Now, we've gone back to having servants again. They're not necessarily in the same guise. Sometimes they're driving cycling bikes and they've got the pizza on the back of it that the student can't be bothered to go and get themselves. Different form. But the last time inequality fell in the UK, things looked very, very similar to how they look at the moment in the UK. I can say it here. I can't say this in the UK because people look at me very angrily, because they feel it more, because it's actually their lives. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Quite some information, and we have 20 minutes left, and I would like to have as many questions answered and put as possible. So we have to do quite let's say short question answer. Any questions here? This side of the room. Anyone wants to kick off the discussion? Anybody? Oh, they're very mute. They're very mute altogether. I can't imagine. Yeah, that's not.
Sorry, it's not a very deep analytical question, but I'm very curious about the privatization of the higher education in the UK. How did this happen? How was it impossible?
How was it achieved? It was a bit like I mentioned David Freud earlier, who in the benefit system, this one man, he was a banker who worked, was a minister in the New Labour, just stayed. Tony Blair brought in fees of £1,000. Just £1,000 a year. Then he raised them in the New Labour to £3,000. Then his friend Lord Mandelson had a chat with David Willett, probably now Lord Willett. And when Labour lost in 2010, they passed the policy on. They invited a man who ran Shell, the big oil business, to have a commission. Lord Brown, another Lord. This is all true. I mean, he's that these are members of the House of Lords who aren't elected. And Lord Brown said it has to be £9,000 a year. And suddenly we're charging young people £9,000 a year to go to university. The state can then reduce how much money it's putting into about £1 billion from 8 or 9. And we're private. And we appear private on the national accounts. That's the key thing. You're not reliant on... You can't... So you're a public service if the government are paying for you out of taxes. And you're private if you sell your goods. If you want a degree? Right? If you sell your goods on the private market. And you're not too regulated. In 2012, they got rid of number controls so that any university can take any number of students. We now have 65% of our young people going to university under the age of 30, the highest in Europe. Actually fell for the first time this year. There is a point at which, no matter how many adverts you put out, there was a point when young people will start saying, actually, what am I going to get for this biggest debt in my life? But that's how they did it. And they did it by Labour and the Conservatives working together. So it's the real danger, in hindsight, I spent my whole life worrying about the Conservative Party. I'm a teenager in the 80s, you learn to hate. And then you wonder, what on earth were those teenagers doing in my city who loved Margaret Thatcher, who became Prime Minister? But the one you have to watch is a Social Democratic Party. It's when your Social Democratic Party turns into a Conservative Party that things are really dangerous. And that's what happened in the UK.
I think also a bit in the Netherlands, which is...
I don't know, so I may be saying things I shouldn't, but like, at least I honestly don't know Dutch politics.
Yes, thank you so much for this lecture. I don't have a background in economic geography, so my question is more about politics, I'm afraid.
You referred to neoliberalism as a failed experiment at some point. And my question is, is there any sort of ideology that can maybe begin to replace it? And do you have thoughts on what that might be?
Well, I think there's lots, but you've got to still deal with that. There are some people who do believe this hasn't been tried enough. Liz Truss, our former Prime Minister, who we have placed a lettuce, by the way, on an island in the river in Oxford in her honour. we have. It's me and my friend and somebody else. So it's beautiful. We made it a statue. Yeah, like Rhodes. There are lots of other ideologies. And there's no reason to believe that there is necessarily a one, although some of you will, you know, the revolution or the environment or being a bit nicer. But the key thing is it's the dangerous ones you've got to avoid. Being undemocratic. I was over the moon when Lord Cameron stepped out of that car on a Monday about a month ago. We had a moment over a weekend where the government were deciding whether to keep the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, who wanted to suspend the power of the courts, at which point you move from being conservative to fascist. Would they keep her or would they replace her? Nobody was told, except Dave was told. You can tell that Dave knew. I'm being a bit mean, but he's my age, and he looked a bit like me. He knew on Thursday, because Dave, when the door opened for the car and we saw who he was, and Google Sky reporters David Cameron to see them laugh. It was shock. He looked like a man who'd eaten nothing all weekend because he knew that all the cameras would be taking his picture. So he kind of fitted in his suit. But anyway, that moment on that second, just a month ago, where you realised that Rishi Sunak, our Prime Minister, had decided not to go down the road of taking away power from the courts, but had decided to go back slightly to that old conservatism. That's a turning point. We could have a government that would suspend the rule of law because they're looking like they're going to lose all their jobs. We've done it before. So it's kind of like a little bit scary, but it looks like they haven't gone for that. I do admit, you can tell you, I'm a mixture of left, pretty, well, it's not that left. Angela Merkel left. German Christian Democrat left wingness. I like the left party in Finland. Mixed with green and environmental and getting that right, and women's parties. So the reason why the left party in Finland is so interesting is the merger of the women's parties and left parties, which is why everybody in charge of it are young women, which is very different from another kind of left that if you're my age, you can get a bit sick of left politics dominated by old men. So that's where I'd look. But the Green parties as well. And you have a coalition of people who are nice in different ways.
We're very good at coalitions here. So
yeah, but you...
A good and nice
program. Yeah. I know you speak. I'm... Go on. Some things last for longer. So the thing I think I didn't know when I was younger and I do now is that when you live in a country, you think that there's huge differences between the political parties in your country. It really matters. You like them, you don't like them. But what happens over time is that all the political parties tend to move together. So in the UK, our Liberal and Conservative Party were pretty far right in 1920. They moved a little bit in policies that they actually did. We introduced in 1934 assisted areas to give money to poor places. Labour Party comes along and wins in 1945. Conservative Party in the 50s built more council houses than Labour, but they're all moving together towards the left. And then they turn in the 70s and they all move together to the right, so that our most left-wing politician, Jeremy Corbyn, is actually slightly to the right of Merkel in Germany. Or I go and spend a summer in Finland interviewing conservative mayors of towns in Finland and quietly chuckle when they tell me about their policies, that I would be called a sort of maniacal Stalinist if I suggested it here. And the only thing that makes the conservative mayors in towns in Finland different from me is they quite like the conscription and the military uniforms for the kids. But on the other hand, if you were next to Russia, you might. But they all move together. You put in place a democratic thing like the EU. I mean, at least the UK leaving has shown it's democratic. You don't have to be in. And that limits something like the death penalty. We can bring the death penalty back now. Yeah, hopefully we won't, but it's kind of a worry. But it's hearts and minds that really change. So generations growing up thinking it's okay to be nice and care about other people, rather than we've done too much caring for other people and that's made us weak. Margaret Thatcher wasn't entirely bad. She had a theory given to her by an economist that if you did things like this, it would eventually benefit everybody. And in the 80s, she signed up for Target 1 of the World Health Organization, which was to halve inequalities in health by area and social class by the year 2000. And she didn't sign up to it as a stunt. Thatcher really believed there'd be trickle down and the results of those policies would actually be better for the poor than the rich. She believed it. It's just that the year 2000 is 23 years ago, right? And we'd already failed to hit it at that point. So that's what I mean by experiment. You could honestly, in the 70s, when most Western countries were much more equal, have said maybe this would work, right? It's just that the last 20 years it's become obvious it really, really doesn't work and things go badly wrong in your societies. But what you do in the future is tricky. I'm not saying I know. I just know that this was wrong and a mistake.
To a sort of economic orthodoxy, let's say, after in the beginning you can see some opposing trends concerning public spending, but you see that more and more this goes to a similar logic. And given that
the UK discovered,
thanks to Margaret, as you say, this orthodoxy quite earlier, to what extent do you think that the UK could be a dystopic projection of other European states?
Okay. Yes, yeah, you could look at that. I mean, it'd be heavily influenced by the yellow line at the top is Sweden. So Sweden in the 80s and 90s, very, very high public. People often write about Sweden then as kind of like nearest to the ideal and wasn't it great in hindsight. And the other is, I think, Belgium. Those two lines are dominating your idea of convergence, but it could be there. Europe as a whole is getting poorer, relatively, and has to get poorer if we're going to have a slightly more equal world. So the big question for Europe and North America and Japan is how are you going to live with a little less in future? And it's not just not to burn the planet. It's because a billion people here and a billion people there who are now going to university in poor parts of the world, aren't going to settle for this. And you can't claim that you're the only people who can make a computer anymore, because we know where they're built. So this is tricky, but all my numbers show me it's entirely possible to go down in terms of your GDP per capita, and for 80% of people to actually be better off. In the UK, the top 10%, which I'm well in, we take 40% of all income. We could take 30, still three times the average. The redistribution of that 10 to the rest would make them all better off. Real changes in our lives. What would happen to me? I might not go skiing. Well, you can look at me and I'm, or twice. I might not have two cars. I might not have a second house. But actually, it's not going to really make me very upset. And I might feel happy about the country I live in. But that's the big thing is that Europe is going to have less overall for many reasons, unless we trash the rest of the world, both politically and environmentally. You know, and hopefully, if you look at the views of young Europeans, they don't seem to want to do that. Although, to give you one worrying one, when you survey young Europeans on their views, they are progressive on everything, except for believing that if they've gone to university, they should be paid much more than other people. Right? That's the only thing which you might think, of course I should, but so many of you have gone to university that you can't. In the UK, 65% have gone to university. How can 65% of you be paid a lot more than everybody else if you've only got 35% left? Do you get the... Or a bit like, I sometimes do lectures like this in the business school. And the questions I normally get at the end of is, and okay, I'll be more political here. If I do it more neutrally, the question I get at the end is, what do I have to do to get in the 1%? But I've heard you tell me how bad everything is. So
we have one more question left there. Yeah. Probably that one.
Yeah. Do you want to know how to get 1%?
No, I actually do. For the income inequality in the progressive, I've been to South Africa. It's clear that if you go to, if the equality is not very high, then it's a problem. But can equality go too far? Can a country be too equal? And what would be the
brilliant question. It's a brilliant question to end on. So with Annika Koljonen, we wrote a book on Finland, published in 2020. And one of the major reasons to try to write the book was the test of can you become too equal? Because at that time, Finland in many ways, Finland scored first, second or third on over 100 social stats, happiest country in the world for 6 years, but very, very equal. And we don't yet know. What does happen is universities can become really tricky because you've got all these people who are really good doing your entrance test, right? And suddenly it's much harder. It was really easy for me to get into university because I wasn't competing because people knew their place in their class. They didn't even apply. Once you've got a country in which everybody thinks that... So there's a problem with meritocracy, with greater equality. My guess is that you can get a pay ratio down to 8-1 at the maximum and be fine. Okay. So somebody being paid at the extremes 8 times more than somebody else. Mm. So for instance, if you're better at work, if you just do a better job, you could argue I should be paid twice as much per hour because I'm just better. If you work for 16 hours rather than 8, I mean, nobody should, but you should be paid twice as much for doing 16 hours. And if your job is dirty and dangerous, I don't know, cleaning sewage, maybe you should pay somebody twice as much. But you can make a moral case that says no job should be so terrible that it should be more than twice that. Nobody should work more than 16 hours a day. And if somebody's better than somebody else, you shouldn't have people who are so awful that they are only half as good as somebody else at a job. They should do something else. So 8-1 is what I can theoretically argue for, and that gives you a much more equal country than Finland. But we need to know. There's loads of things we need to know. We have all these basic income experiments. Most of them seem to be positive. Do they allow people to live a very low consumption lifestyle and emit very little carbon and be happy? There's all kinds of things we need to know to work out. But the biggest worry that I see from Finland is not mental health. That's still one of the best amongst young people in Europe. It is, how do you sort out things like who gets to do a PhD when so much of your population are so well educated that they could absolutely do a PhD? How on earth do you sort that out? Now, it's kind of like a problem it's nice to have, but those are the problems of greater equality.
Luxury. Good. Okay. I would like to have one big round of applause again. Yeah.